We have a, I have a long history with the school. I didn't go here, like Scott Heron. I have to claim that my wife was the first school counselor here, like a long time ago. So I'm really grateful to be here. We have lots of overlap over lots of years, and I just am encouraged that this many people would come out on a Thursday morning to think about the idea of what it means to raise a wholehearted child. And so you're already ahead of the curve, because all the other parents that aren't here are as good as you. And they don't love their kids as much. So especially the dads in the room, like, kudos to you. Seriously. I think often, especially with younger kids, it's easy for us to sideline ourselves in their development. And so I'm really appreciative to see your faces and have your hearts in the room. And that's important to me. I'll make a couple remarks to start, and then we'll just dialogue. Like, I'm kind of over me talking for long periods of time. And I don't know how much I have to say, but I think y'all have a lot to wonder about, and I have some ideas, and I have a lot of questions too about this whole parenting thing. My children are 24, almost 21, 18, 18. So we're in a different part of this experiment of parenting. And it's just different. It's hard in different ways. It's wonderful in different ways. It's weird in different ways. There's probably not a weirder time of parenting than puberty. Will and I were talking about that. So good thing we don't have to talk about that today, because it's weird. So it's bookended by these other things called, like, hope and life. But there's, there's a dark liminal space of puberty. And so it's like crossing over sticks and going into Hades and coming back. So it's a little classical reference there from my ABA friends. So I'll make some remarks. We'll talk, and maybe we'll learn something together. The reason I do this, because I'm just tired of talking all the time, but it also, I was taught a few years ago, the way Jesus learned Scripture was not the way we tend to learn anymore. It was done in a rabbinical community where they would unroll the scrolls, the holy text. So they didn't have a Bible. They had scrolls that were in these cases on the wall, and they'd pull the scroll out and they'd unroll it on the floor. And they would, the older rabbis would sit around the scroll, like two or three or four or five, and then their students, and then like in concentric rings outside of that, people would sit. And the rabbis would discuss the scroll and have a conversation about what Isaiah was talking about, right? Or what Genesis meant. And they would have this beautiful conversation, their different perspectives, and their belief was that in the conversation, in the communal interaction, that the truth would hover above the text and fall into people's hearts. And then they would write the notes of the conversation on the edges of the scroll. And then they would put those scrolls back into the wall. And then they would pull them out. And so forever and ever, but the belief and the practice was the words written around the edges were as sacred as the words in the text. And so I think the practice of us having a conversation about what it means to raise children is actually a sacred, deep spiritual practice of listening, of attending, of being open, being curious. So I promise you will not leave here with three things to go do. You might have a thousand things to go do to raise emotionally healthy children. But you might leave here with a better idea about what it means to be the version of you. I love that sound. And so, dude, that's wonderful. Keep that going. What it means to be a version of you in the world, that you're being invited to participate in the grand narrative of God. And in a small way, that's the life of children. And in a big way, it's the life of children. So hopefully we'll have a conversation around that. So that's kind of some framework. I will say this about parenting. I've written a couple of books. One of them is like really popular, called Wild Things, Art of Nurturing Boys. It's really good. It's got some MySpace references in it, though. So it's but the publisher makes so much money on it, they don't want to like republish it. They don't want to take it back and change it. So some outdated stuff in there, but I think generally it's true. It talks about the arc of the journey of the boy. and what he means for his parents. I wrote another book years ago with Chip Dodd that I'm really proud of, and I would recommend to all of you. It's called Parenting with Heart. And it really is about this two-step movement of these four. The first half of the book is what you need to do with you so that you can go love your child. Right? So the number one flaw, number one false thinking that we have as children of the Industrial Revolution is that children are products that we're trying to produce as opposed to are trees we're trying to grow. Right? And so we are children of the Industrial Revolution. We think in efficiencies. We think in outcomes. We don't natively think in processes. Unless you grew up on a farm where you planted seeds and then waited to see what God was going to do. Because it might be a drought. It might be a flood. It might be just right. And a bounty harvest comes that year. And you have nothing to do with it except you planted the seeds and waited. Right, that's an agrarian model, which I think is a much better adaptation for parenting to think of yourself as a farmer than it is to think of yourself as an engineer or a factory producer. There's nothing efficient about parenting. And children are great at reminding us of that. Watch me jump off the diving board again. Watch me do it again. Watch, Mommy. Hey, Daddy. There's a guy on Instagram. Like, I don't recommend social media. It's really bad for you. There is no evidence, psychological evidence, that says it does anything for you except monetize your unconsciousness for the sake of Mark Zuckerberg. Tim Estes, who's a parent here, basically scared me to death. I went home and I deleted like pretty much every app on my phone last night because it's like, it's evil. It's actually the face of evil. But there's a really cool character. like all good humans, don't we like to juggle with a little bit of evils when we die? There's a guy, and I think he's from Tennessee, And he plays this part where he's like a four-year-old. Y'all seen this? Where his cowboy hat, hey, Daddy! And he'll like interrupt his dad. His dad always does something important, and the kid's always got something unimportant to ask him about. Like, why are you looking at that woman in the grocery store, Daddy? Kind of weird stuff, like a four-year-old, right? And then the daddy will say something, and forgive me. The little boy will go, it's like, it's so funny, right? Because this guy has instinctively done something. He knows somehow that the best we get as humans is 4 years old. That's the best we get. It's the best we get. Everything else is skill acquisition, formation, but from a quality of being a human, 4 years old, I think, is the pinnacle. Because you're curious, you're open, you're loving, you're forgiving, you believe, you also doubt, you wonder, you're curious, you're engaged, you're not judgmental. I mean, it's just like you dream, you cry, and then get over it, you know? And you start crying about the right things at four, you know? Not just everything, right? You become a little bit like tenderhearted and begin to be other focused. Your personality starts to show itself. 4 years old is the best your kids get. And it's the best you ever were. So if you leave with anything, leave with this. If you parent your child like you're a four-year-old, you'll do great. You'll be great. If you parent them like a factory superintendent, or like a line producer, that's awesome for me because Scott and I run a Leadership Development Institute, and I also am a participant in a counseling center called Stay Chill, and we're going to need clients forever. So I just would encourage you to like produce the heck out of them, and we'll come talk to us later. We'll fix that all. That's so fun too, because that's a redemptive work also. And so the best you get, the best you got was four, and the best they'll get's four, and it's just. Right? And I think a lot of what the energy I put into parenting and still do comes from like this twofold places. It's this alchemy of weirdness called deep, deep love and terror and shame. Like, I so love my children like I've never, God, like I've never loved anything. I so love them. And I'm so scared for them and for me. And I so need them to represent me in the world in a way that's not good. And so that weird alchemy is what parenting is. And what we're always trying to like be aware of and step into and step out of and And if you know you're dancing that, you're doing great. You're doing great. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you need help. Because the number one thing, two things I want you to walk away with, the number one thing you can do to raise emotionally healthy kids is you be emotionally healthy. It's the number one thing you can do. Number one thing you can do. Which means 4 out of 10 men and 6 out of 10 women were sexually abused before the age of 18. You need to deal with that. You need to deal with that. You need to understand the trauma that you've been through. Half of us in this room grew up in homes that were, 42% of us in this room grew up in homes that were, divorce was at the center of the parents' conflict, was the epicenter of our experience. You need to deal with that. It affected you. Addiction is the pandemic of the world. And I wrote a book with Chip Dodd called, it's supposed to be called The Pandemic. And then this thing happened. So it's called Hope in the Age of Addiction. Because there is a pandemic of addiction. And in Christian circles, we call it idolatry or sin. But there really is a neurological process when you're obsessed with something that will save you from having to be human. And it ends up owning us. And we don't even have to think about our lives because it's thinking about it for us. We start seeking out and re-seeking behaviors that take us away from who we are to be and how we make live. We end up being possessed by a spirit not of this world. That's addiction. And it is killing people. And it's killing some of y'all in this room. And if for the sake of love of your children, the sake of love of yourself, it can help. It's so helpable. It's so helpable. And it will put you on a spiritual path that is ancient and true. It'll be like to continue to flourish. You have so much more to give away. So that's my heavy-handed cry to y'all. If you really are serious about raising emotionally healthy kids, deal with your trauma. Deal with the dark places in your life where shame has a foothold on your soul. Deal with the root of your fear and terror that you don't really believe that that God, the universe, has your good in mind because it felt like or he did turn his back on you at key points in your life. And you feel like it's all up to you to manage the world. As you deal with those issues of shame and fear and the root of where they came from, begin to heal and grow through that, you'll have nothing but love and grace and wisdom to offer your children. And if you don't, you'll have love and fear and shame. So we can keep talking or I can go. Seriously, like we can keep talking or I can go. Yeah, what do we need to talk about? And that's a little heavy-handed, but I really believe in this. I really believe that is the path if I'm going to offer my children what they need for me, because they need me. I'm not a factory worker. I'm a parent. And the more they grow, I need to grow to be in their life. What do we need? What questions, comments, observations, complaints, critiques?
I'm curious of what you have to say just about with so many conversations with so many kids that have spectrum diagnoses.
I've got one.
Yeah, and I have one too. And because it's very difficult to connect on a that emotionally heart level, we try so hard to like speak in language of heart, and it feels like, you know, we just feel like we're banging our head against the wall.
You are. You are. I am. You are. It's one of my greatest grief points right now is I'm hard-headed and stubborn and passionate, and I'll run through a wall, and before I really had got clarity and acceptance around one of my children's spectrum disorders, I tried to bully my way into his heart instead of loving him for who he was. So if being a parent is a reflection of how God loves us, then think about how lonely God is for us and how much love there is to wait in the steadfastness of loneliness and love another without return. Like, that is the hallmark of love. And I do think spectrum disorder kids, that's a grace they teach us if we're willing to accept the pain of it and the grace of it. That I'm loving this child that may not ever be able to reciprocate. I'm not sure it's getting in. I do believe it is. It just comes out in weird ways.
Do you think that rescuing is that we, me and my wife, we find ourselves almost like removing some of the natural consequences of just his own, you know, behaviors or whatever.
Yeah.
And so then we rescue, and they were like, gosh, maybe we need to like let him experience.
Bob, yeah. I don't know, man. Yeah. I don't know. It's not about the outcome. Yeah. Whenever you're thinking about preparing for the outcome, you're thinking like a factory worker, or an engineer, like it's about a farmer. And you're like, I don't know, man, it's like, this is good. But to get descriptive, like to be descriptive, they get to be prescriptive about you. You have to like know a lot about your kid and a lot about you and a lot about the moment. And a lot's like, I don't know. But I do think it's somewhere in the tension of removing barriers and then putting in boundaries. Right? Something about that sounds right. So you're thinking in the right categories. Right? And, I, you know, 23, 21, 18, 18. I'd be great at parenting your kids. we used to work at the nursery at our church, and these sweet parents would bring their cute little, like, one-year-old kids, and they'd be crying, and we're like, this is so easy. And the mom's like, they call me and this and that, and the dad's like, okay, she's going to kick my ass if the baby cries. Yeah, we got it. Like, this is easy. It's like a broom full of, like, people who want to be grandparents. Like, we got the little kids down, you know? So I promise, like, in 10 years, you'll go like, oh, yeah, I got the answer to what I should have done back then, you know? But I think just that you're asking the question, you're thinking, those are the right categories. What barriers do I need to remove because they're not really what he needs in this season? And what are the ones I need to put in place so that he is encountering his own choices and own consequences that come from his choice? Hey.
I wanted to add something. I don't know if you've read the book. It's called, I always forget the name, Born on a Blue Day by Daniel Tammet, because he is has Asperger's, and he kind of writes his story on how he discovered and was diagnosed and what it felt like to him to have Asperger's and live with it. And when I read it, it completely changed my understanding of, you know, kids on the spectrum.
That's probably better than Parent with Heart, quite frankly. That's Born on a Blue Day.
Yeah. Top three books that I treasure, and one of my, for me, it was like changing, and I still go back to reflecting on that book as I'm parenting and understanding that my daughter can have her own experiences in her own way that I may not understand and relate, but that respecting that it's her experience.
Oh,
so,
yeah. Thanks for that.
So progressive for a Christian. Yeah. You're in the South. You know you're in the South, right? People have their own lived experience. That's something they say in California. Did you move here from California? Motorcycle riding, there's beaches, there's San Diego.
I think this is where I've learned the passion for children, especially children on the spectrum. Yeah. She's a therapist too.
It's good.
I'm a parent first. I'm here as a parent. Yeah. With also learning and long support.
It's all practice, isn't it? Yeah. It's all practice.
It's a process.
Yeah, it's a process.
Trial and error.
I think there's something in that even broader, though, for us, too, is my daughter, she said I could share the story, which I used to tell stories about my kids without their permission, but now they have feelings about that. She said when she was little, we would say, hey, what are you thinking? We're thinking of engaging our kids. And she's like, would tell us. And she would talk. She's like, oh, this is so sweet. And then she told us years later, at some point around like 6 or 7, she realized she didn't have to tell us what she was thinking. It was a massively transformative experience for her. And it's like, I don't have to tell them. So I will lie.
Yeah.
Which is pretty good. And then the greatest blessing your children can give you is when they come back to the house at like 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 30, and they tell you how you failed them. It's a great blessing, because if they believe they can do that with you, they believe you can take it. And think of the rest of the room who we know we can't go do that from where we came from because they can't handle it. Because we emotionally, psychologically, spiritually passed our parents a long time ago. Right? And so they can come back to you and say, hey, I lied to you since I was 7. I'm a really private person and you're invasive. That's accurate. And I'm sorry, what do you need? And she's like, I need, and then she like laid it out. I was like, and so that one is acting something right. But here's my new phrase as a parent. They get all the credit. All the credit goes to them. Because you know why? If they get all the credit, what happens? I don't get any of the blame. Because it can't be credit to them and all my fault. Right? Either they get all the credit and all the responsibility, or I get all the credit and all the responsibility. It's actually somewhere, some dance in between. What I'm learning now, with a little more experience, is that my kids are making decisions about who they are in the world from very early ages. It had nothing to do with my input. They actually get to decide who they are, which is what you're saying. They have this, and they get to decide who they are before they have any life experience to know if that's good or bad. They're just trying on stuff, trying out stuff. And most of the time, they're like taking on what you say and pushing against what you say at the same time. And they're building this whole unconscious psychology about their identity in the world. And they finish growing up around, at my age, we finish growing up like mid-20s. At your kids' age, based on the science now, they're going to hit maturity mid-30s. All the science, shows this is bad, and these little tablets are bad, and little computers are bad for their brain development. And there's some other things that have happened besides that. People used to get married and have children as a part of the maturation rite of passage process. Now it's optional. Culturally, culture has shifted, and family, that is an American problem, actually, that family is the center of culture is a problem. It's creating a lot of weird narcissistic disorders in children and anxiety disorders. But we'll talk about that in a minute. But the family and community used to be the center, right? And now, because of technology and because of different things, I become my own center. And you think about the anxiety that creates. In our culture is very much at this point that you're the center. You get to decide your lived truth. You get to decide your experience. You can decide who you are. Yes, because we're going to do that anyway. But we have to do it in community. It's always in community. Like, we don't know ourselves without being in community. We don't exist as a person without community. We go insane. And so we used to have some rites of passage called marriage, having children, taking on responsibilities. And we used to get married not for romantic ideals or self-fulfillment. We got married for economic necessity. It's like, we got to get married because it's easier for two people to work the farm. Because you couldn't, until post-World War II in America, it took two incomes at least to keep a couple people alive. It was not this idea that like mom stayed home and dad went to work. It's a post-World War II 1950s idea because we became so rich because we financed a war and got a lot of money back in America. Everyone was devastated and we weren't because of isolationism. That we were able to create a lot of things and people bought things and everybody owed us money. And so we had all this money going on. And I would, if I had enough money not to work, I'd probably not work too. Right? And so that happened, and we turned that into an ideal. And I'm not saying it's bad. Like, Heather opted out of working for lots of seasons of our children's living. And it's been both good for them and bad for her, and good for her and bad for them. Like, it's been a thing. And it was good in most ways, right? But we used to not have that. It used to be like, hey, you 14, you gotta go to work. And then you have this thing called, like, you go to university, which is adult preschool. College is adult preschool for most people, right? You get to go do, now it's like stuff shows up on social media. It's not adult preschool. It's like adult preschool with cameras, with videos that follow you forever. That's so strange. Because I can't run for office just because there's people with memories of me in college, right? It's like, yeah, I did do that. I probably shouldn't run for office, right? I mean, it's like, so all this stuff is accelerated individual isolation, individual thought processes. We've removed rites of passage of social responsibility. There's no longer a fabric in our culture where responsibility, I have a responsibility to participate as a civic contributor. We're all consumers, right? And so because we're consumers, we're looking for our own happiness and our own comfort. And so what the effect on children is they don't assign themselves noble responsibilities. And so what we know in men in neuroscience studies is the male brain doesn't finish developing until they take on responsibilities bigger than themselves. And the two primary responsibilities that a man takes on is getting married and having children. Because then you have anxiety. We used to get married. You were 22 and you got married. 22, right? So our brains had kids at 27, 28. Okay? Our brains developed. So that's biological fact. But that idea of like men's brains develop when they take on responsibility for themselves. And this, the brain study is different in women. It's a different, that's not a reproducible study for women. It is the typical male brain. And there is a typical male brain. And so it's the rite of passage of getting married and having kids is optional now. And so when men get married in their 30s and they're mostly concerned with playing video games with their friends, I'm not saying it's bad to get married in your 30s. It's a cultural thing, right? I don't think it's good for kids to go to work at like 12, 13. That's a cultural necessity. So things have changed. Not everything's good, bad. Some things just are. But one of the outcomes of men specifically playing video games with their buddies, taking golf trips, and only focused on themselves and their happiness is that they don't mature. They don't grow up. Yeah? And so that's part of it. That's another reason, right? The kids are having a hard time and we're not hitting a puberty, not finishing development, brain development, or puberty, and men specifically, until their 30s. Like 31, 32 is the thing now. So your kids has got to be older. Unless you go buy a farm and go to work and then marry them off to the girl next door, because for most of history, arranged marriages are how it all worked. Only it wasn't until the 1700s that we started thinking about romantic ideals for getting married. That's a new idea in the development of humans, that we get married because we fall in love. We got married out of economic necessity and because my daddy knew your daddy, and they thought we lived in the same village and we weren't that related. Right? So it's really cool to strip out the ideals that we think family's supposed to be. We go back to what the core is of like people communing with one another and then people growing and communing with other people and all that. So that's weird. I got way off into like anthropology right there. So, yes.
I'm selfishly going to ask you a couple questions.
I love it.
You're on the topic.
There's smart people in the room to answer.
I've got a house full of boys.
Oh, that's great.
And it's such a, I know, right? It's wild. It's fun, but it's a wide range. I've got one that, like, I honestly wish sometimes he would talk to me less.
Yeah.
And then I've one that's, like, basically mute.
Yeah.
So kind of two-part question. For the mute one, I'm thinking about your comments about your daughter feeling invaded when you're asking. How do you appropriately get them to not be mute? Mm-hmm. That's the one. And then,
so how come you need them not to be mute?
Well, I worry about what he's struggling with, that he's not asking for help. Maybe he doesn't need help, and maybe that's your point. I don't know.
I don't know your son.
Yeah.
But like laying claim into the strange alchemy of love, fear, and shame.
Yeah.
And to go, okay, part of me wanting to engage him is my fear that something's going on I don't know about. Yeah. It's like, wonderful that you're afraid. It's scary to parent children, especially children who won't say things. And because you wonder, you probably think he's thinking things. Because if he's not, that's a problem. It's like, how can you not think things?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like, so it's a problem either way. You're right to be afraid. Yeah, so what else? What else keeps him?
Well, the one that talks all the time,
he takes
you have
so
a
much
better
space. Is he the oldest?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. There always has to be an oldest child. We're so
right? But you know where they are, and you know, like, what's going on, and then the one that's mute, you're like, I love you, buddy. Oh my God. Just, do you even, is this processing with you?
Well, here's some relief. Here's some relief. The children get their self-concept from the next oldest sibling.
More than he's in trouble parent. Then.
Yeah. Maybe he's learned that to be your own counsel is a pretty good thing in the world.
Okay.
Like, that's a pretty good trait, to be your own counsel. In a world of extroversion, where you win friends and influence people as a social value, you're worried about your child. In a world where psychology is like a social value, like personal insight and like sharing your feelings and talking about, we really value that. We used to value people who sat around and thought about things. It was not too long ago that Abraham Lincoln was held up for being a melancholy man. He was esteemed by culture for being melancholy. He would sit alone and be sad. And that was a cultural value that we adored and admired in that person. And now we have a clinical diagnosis for that. We label that as a negative personality trait. One of the greatest leaders of modern times, he's also super ambitious and ego-driven, but bore the weight of a falling apart country and a mentally ill wife and a dying child. He bore that weight and sat around and thought about stuff. And so he knew pain, and out of his pain, he invented Thanksgiving. That we need to pause in war, and everybody go home and take stock of what you're thankful for. That came out of sitting in solitude. So I don't know what your son's doing. I get your fear. I'd be afraid too. Because it's either he's thinking things he's not sharing and you can't help him with and needs help. And he's making all kinds of decisions out of like no life experience. And he's going to make bad decisions. You know? And that's going to hurt him and you. And that sucks. It's awful. Or he's not thinking anything and that's bad too. Right? He also could be thinking wonderful things. You know? You could just be a thinker.
I'm hopeful for that.
Yeah. I would wonder if he doesn't, how is he speaking? Like, not verbally.
Very physical.
So, yeah. How old is he?
7.
Yeah. So, do y'all play?
All the time.
You like wrestle or like, what do you do? 7's almost too old. You'll get hurt wrestling. So, go out, that's how your son speaks. He doesn't use words. He uses physical interaction.
Yeah.
And he might have to learn to use words later.
Yeah.
You know?
He's the guy that'll like come and tackle you to show you that he loves you.
That's, I love that kid. Like, no, that's boy. That's boy. That's boy. You know?
Yeah. Maybe not the best thing to do to your teacher during class.
But I don't know. Like, so it's not do you tackle your teacher. Which teachers can you tackle to show affection?
Yeah.
Because not all teachers, you have to start learning to discriminate. And to go, oh, I live in community. I don't just get to have my way on the world. That my way actually impacts people differently. And he's old enough at 7 to start going, there's some people you tackle. There's some people you high five. There's some people you hug. There's some people you just kind of do this with. And you don't make the assumption that I just get to love people the way I want to love them.
That's helpful.
Right? And so now he's learning his way of being in the world. But I've got one of those. And he keeps his own counsel. That's also a valuable thing. I need to learn more of that. I need to learn to sit and think sometimes. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's tough. Yeah. God, those are great questions.
I got a question.
Chad Tubbs got a question.
I always got a question. Crazy thing, I'm actually really drawn to the farming analogy. And I'm thinking a lot about like the men and the responsibility thing too. And so I'm curious, especially boys, as you think about how to like kind of raise them in the way they should go, right? Yeah. And give them responsibility in a farming way versus like, I'm very much like, you're responsible to do this. Why'd you not do it? You know what I mean? Versus like, and so I'm just curious, like, what is that? I think that's the question. Like, what does that look like? Especially, you know, for people like me that are trying to lead companies and like, it's very good to have to be black and white. Cause I'm not black and white. You're going to like, you know, does that make sense? And like, sure. How do you, I'm just trying to reconcile that a little bit.
Well, you think about the about child a lot. It's like, hey, we're making dinner together. You're responsible for this part. How can I help you? Like, you be in charge of this. Can you tell us how to get here? Like, that's a responsibility, right? You make, like, what do you want to do for this? You're giving them responsibility. You're also like, hey, you have chores. Because this thing didn't run on its own. and I'm not your maid. You know? So like now you're in a family. One day you won't be, but until you leave, we do this together. I've got one child left at home and he's like, I can't wait till people come home for Christmas so other people can take out the garbage and other people can wash off. And could we all take out the garbage? I'm the only one that takes it out of the can. Like everybody in my family is like committed to stuffing that can as high as possible. And I'm like, gosh, this is, you know how hard it is to get the trash out. So it's like, there's two times that recently that I've like lost it. It's like, everybody come in here. Everybody is Heather and Henry. And like the dog's like, yes. It's like, when are we gonna do the trash differently? And Heather said, you're the only one that cares about this. It's like, it feels that way. It feels like you're the only one. It's the right way to do the trash.
Just so they're not alone.
And so, like, there's shared responsibilities, and then they have their own responsibilities called their grades. They're grades. They're not my grades. You know? Their sports team, not my sports team. And if you're going to be on a sports team, if you're going to go to school, which is not optional, it's compulsory, there are some standards you have to keep up, right? But they're your grades, man. Like, how are you doing with your grades? And so I think the responsibility of calling them to own their life and giving them the tools it takes to own their life, which isn't just what I got, was like, no instruction, you're on your own, figure it out. I became highly responsible, hyper-vigilant. Like, my standards are so up here, because if we don't hit them, the world's going to fall apart. Like, it really could fall apart, Chad. Like, the whole world could fall apart right now. Like, you know what would happen if I didn't exist? The world would keep on going just fine. In some ways, better, right? At least I'm not messing up my corner of it. But I really think that it's my job to keep the universe intact at times. It's the wrap-up time. So much we talk about. I didn't hit snooze either, I didn't stop. So, like, the idea of, like, yes, give them responsibility, but your responsibility, as you said, to train them up the way they should go, which means, in the beginning, it's like, I'm going to vacuum the house with you. I'm going to, they want to be with you. Mm-hmm. They're not workers, they're children, right? So how do you make it play? Play is the language of children. So how do you make everything play? How do you make responsibility play? Because we would have these times when we'd clean out the basement. I thought it was fun. Like, you do this, I do this. It was like, the job was to clean out the basement. Everybody in the family hated it. Right? I was like, they would come down and I said, this attitude is why you hate it. They're like, no, Dad, like, it's you. Like, so I'll end with this. To raise emotionally healthy children, they need to be able to hate you to their core. Because if they can't hate you, they can't love you. And if they don't love you, they won't hate you, right? Because love and hate are like real close. It doesn't mean you piss them off on purpose, because sometimes that's fun too. But it is like, are you living a vibrant life where they can play out their drama on you and with you, and you play out your drama on them and with them? Because you're the parent, you go, I crossed the line. I messed up. I'm sorry. Are you the kind of parent that says, I'm sorry regularly? Not, I'm sorry, but, which is not an apology. So to live out redemption in the family is to lean in, mess up, own up, and move on. Okay? So if you take responsibility for you, you'll know what responsibilities they can carry. And if they're children, you know they're going to not do them well. And because they're children, they're practicing. Right? It's like, of course you screwed that up. You're a kid. And like, it's like, oh yeah. Now, you're also, last thing, you're raising 50-year-olds. So the test is, what kind of 50-year-old are they going to be? I used to say 30-year-olds. It's like, no, it's 50-year-olds. Because I'm 50. So you're raising 50-year-olds. You're probably raising 70. What kind of grandparent are you raising? What kind of grandparent are you cultivating? Right? And so if you start looking at your child like a future grandparent, you might make some different decisions about how over-programmed they are after school. And how much anxiety that creates in the world. And how they just need to go, like, play outside, go look at walnuts, you know, and go dream, and go draw, and go, like, do whatever they need to do. That's instead of going to underwater ballet on Tuesday, football on Thursday, art class on Friday, because I want to produce a well-rounded kid. I want my child to be emotionally healthy and well-rounded. And you're asking these really great questions. And there's not easy answers. There's no easy answer. It's as hard as it feels. Okay? If you love something, it's as hard as it feels. So if it is this hard, it's not going to get easier. It is this hard, and the hard is worth it. Their heart is worth it, and your heart's worth it. So every time you're thinking for the easy way out, the more efficient way with your child, you're in a factory mindset, and you are going to mess them up and mess yourself up in the process. And you will do that on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays. Now, the other days of the week, the balance, the other 4 days of the week, like, can you see yourself as a farmer? Can you see yourself as a gardener of their roses? Can you see yourself as pouring water on the grandparent? Can you see yourself as, like, nurturing something for yourself and somebody else, and asking them to co-participate in the labors of the garden with you? And that's a beautiful way to think about people.